You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Green Left Weekly Radio.
There's one newspaper that is independent of powerful capitalist interests, and that is Green Left Weekly.
It's the people's voice, committed to human and civil rights, ecological sustainability, democracy and equality. It presents ideas that the mainstream media won't.
Green Left is a leading source of local, national and international news with analysis, discussion and debate to strengthen the anti-capitalist movement.
It helps expose the lies of the capitalist press and puts the voices of the marginalised and the oppressed at the centre of fighting for a better world and helps us understand the political developments unfolding around us.
Good morning, listeners. You are listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR on 855 AM. And you are joined today by myself, Jacob Andwafer, who's going to be one of your presenters. And I'm very happy to be joined by our co-presenter,
Mary Merkinich.
Yeah, so actually, maybe Mary, you wanted to start off by giving the acknowledgement of country?
Sure. So 3CR and Green Left acknowledges that this show is being broadcasted from the land of the Wurundjeri Woi Wurrung. They are the rightful sovereign owners, storytellers and the caretakers of this land. They never ceded sovereignty and colonisation continues to this day. As socialists, we pledge to actively support decolonisation. We stand with all the First Peoples in their struggle for justice and the right to their land. Always was and always will be Aboriginal land.
Hear, hear. Now, to announce what we have coming up on our program this week, we have quite a packed program. So we're going to be interviewing Isabel from the Fight the Crisis, who is a Inner North teacher who's been quite active in the teachers union, and we'll basically be giving a perspective on this current deal that's being proposed by the AU and is currently being negotiated between the state government and the union. Although that said, one of the important things about this interview is actually giving a bit of a message that this deal isn't necessarily a done deal. And in fact, if you follow the kind of mainstream sort of media, if you follow what the Labour politicians are saying, they're all acting like this deal has essentially passed. So we're looking forward to actually interviewing Isabel to actually talk about what is actually the fine detail of this new agreement for teachers that is currently being debated and proposed to the membership. Then we'll be speaking to Marybeck and Socialist Alliance state election candidate for Broadmeadows, Sue Bolton, about the rise of One Nation and the need for a left alternative. And then we'll be speaking with Kelly Whitworth from the Homeless Persons Union and also a fellow 3CR presenter about the tax on the homeless by the City of Melbourne City Council. So yeah, we've got quite a lot of important topics covered this week. And I guess the kind of first story in term I want to kind of cover is the kind of latest kind of headline news around the flotilla. So many listeners have probably been following that. The Global Samud Flotilla was en route to to Palestine, and very much similar to kind of previous flotillas, was very much had volunteers from all over the world, very much aiming to deliver life saving aid to Gaza, and. Probably what are the few things that has happened is a number of activists had already been intercepted, like a number of boats had already been intercepted by Israel beforehand, and some of them have already been deported back to their home country. In fact, I'm aware that there is one activist who has already come back from who was part of the Australian delegation and had already been back in Australia for the past two several weeks. In fact, we almost interviewed him last a few Fridays ago, but yeah, unfortunately, that we weren't able to get that interview. But there were still a number of Global Summit Flotilla participants who were en route to Gaza, but then they had been recently detained by Israeli forces. And quite shamefully, we saw the really horrific kind of images, although of course these images are nothing compared to what Palestinians experience on a regular basis. A lot of Flotilla activists were basically detained by Israel forces, and there was video footage by the far-right Israeli minister. What's his name again?
Ben Kavir,
basically taunting the activists while they've been detained in a kind of fetal kind of position. And you know, that footage had essentially gone viral overnight from yesterday, and has provoked actually widespread condemnation from a number of countries which have participants for the flotilla. That includes Italy, that includes Australia. In fact, you could have to say Penny Wong probably made one of the stronger statements she's made in the past, basically, you know, condemning Israel's actions as contemptible and so on. You know, of course, never really used the same language for Israel's genocide of Gaza. This has basically clearly caused a bit of a diplomatic outcry from many nations who have, you know, seen this this footage. Probably the positive kind of news is that as of today, pretty much all the activists, have been deported back to Turkey. Not that I'm saying that that's necessarily a good thing in a sense that it's obviously, you know, not a positive thing that obviously the flotilla didn't end up reaching Gaza. But I think in terms of the safety of the activists, this is obviously a good positive story in a sense that, you know, a lot of them will become on their route back home. But, you know, just shows that, you know, we have to keep going. And I think, you know, there needs to be more global summit flotillas, but then there also needs to be more protests. I mean, I think at the end of, last year, or was it, there was some incredible strike action by Italian dock workers in solidarity with the global summit flotilla. And I think there's just a lot to kind of say about what this kind of reveals about Israeli society. You know, Mary, did you sort of want to have some comments to sort of add to this?
Yeah. Well, firstly, I think the fact that Penny Wong said something, it's only, I believe, because she was shamed into having to make a statement. Because how can you defend this? And if this video hadn't existed, we probably would have heard zilch from the Australian government. That's what I think about that. But also, you can see Kavir in this video, and he's clearly trying to shame the participants of the flotilla. But in fact, what he's ended up doing is shaming Israel even more than what it has been. And I think it also verifies all of the statements that participants have made on previous journeys to try and break this blockade, of medicines, of food, of water for Palestinians, where participants have said that they have been mishandled, abused. Some have alleged that they were raped, sexually assaulted. And, of course, the Israeli government has denied it. But I think what we saw, or what you can see in the video, just underscores what they've been saying for ages, and it verifies that they're telling the truth. Last night I saw the father of one of the Australian activists, a young woman called Neve, and that interview was just fabulous. But he also disputed the fact that the Israeli ambassador said that they were treated with, I can't remember the exact words, but they're saying something like the highest sensitivity. You know, clearly that's not the case. And I've heard even this morning on the news that Some of the participants have had to be admitted to hospital because of injuries that they have suffered. So much for the highest sensitivity.
Oh, yeah. You know, I think that it's absolutely appalling how, you know, I mean, we're not surprised. I mean, at the end of the day, Israel is an apartheid state that is, you know, very much committing genocide against the Palestinians, the continued occupation, the dispossession of the Palestinians. I mean, how they've treated the flotilla participants is really no surprise. I think a few things I also want to kind of unpack here is, and this says a lot about the nature of Israel society, especially in terms of, you know, being a settler colonial kind of state, that one of the elements of, you know, there was a certain level of posture with this video by Ben-Gvir, because essentially there is legislative elections happening in Israel in October. You know, Ben-Gvir is part of a very kind of ultra-nationalist sort of far-right party in Israel, which is probably only has like 6 seats in their kind of legislative sort of council. And one of the things about, you could say, about a video like this is, for a far-right party in the context of Israeli society, it is very much used this video as a kind of posture to kind of show how, you know, strong and tough they are against so-called enemies of Israel. So, you know, there was a certain political purpose to this video, which was actually to kind of, in a sense, win votes and win support of the kind of ultra kind of nationalist sort of forces within Israel. And that's not to say, though, that's not to give any sort of really any legitimacy to kind of Israeli political society, because, I mean, all the parties, in it, most of the majority of parties in Israel all support the occupation. They all support the genocide. It's just that there's obviously different wings of the movement. There's a more liberal wing, etc. And Ben-Gvir kind of represents the most ultra-right, sort of far-right nationalist expression. And in fact, yeah, the Albanese government has also tried to use this, the fact that they are different sort of political perspectives in Israel, to sort of distance themselves from. So, you know, they'll distance themselves from Ben-Gvir. In fact, they've imposed sanctions on him. But then they'll sort of they'll attempt to kind of legitimize Israel as like, oh, well, Israel is just a normal, everyday democratic society. But, you know, at the end of the day, I mean, Benjamin Netanyahu actually condemned the treatment of the Global Summit flotilla participants. But then, you know, he had to follow up with, well, we want to deport them as soon as possible. So it's sort of like there's not really that kind of meaningful difference in actual reality.
And they justify arresting them in international waters stopping them from being able to bring much needed aid to the Palestinians. So they're not really arguing against what Ben-Gvir was doing. They're just, you know, that he was caught on video.
Yeah. Well, I think that's the most important point I just want to end it on.
Sorry.
The end that, I think you made a good point. I think you, just following on from what you said, Mary, this is the most important point to kind of end on is, the only reason this flotilla exists and is happening is because Israel is denying life-saving aid, all sorts of products to Gaza currently right now. So yeah. It's sort of like that is clearly, while Penny Wong can go on and pontificate about how, oh, it's so outrageous that, you know, fellow Australians were treated this way by the Israeli government, she has been awfully silent on why are these Australians participating in this global summit flitter? There's actually a political context that actually even the mainstream, who have been willing to condemn the far right the actions of the far right politician Ben-Gvir, have not been willing to really openly talk about.
Yeah, well, Palestinians are living in tents made out of whatever they can find, plastic sheeting, etc. That they don't even have housing. And if you live in a bombed out building with no doors or windows, you're considered lucky. So, and you know, those buildings are very unstable. so they could collapse at any time. So that just, again, highlights the situation that Palestinians are facing.
Yeah. Well, we'll go finish up there, and maybe we'll go on to our first live interview for the program. I'll just play a quick community announcement. You're listening to Green Left Radio.
The media in this country, we as Indigenous people know, have censored our right of telling the truth, and the truth is what this country is most fearful of, in particular Indigenous truths. Until history is told by the vanquished lens, which is our people telling our story our way, and have the right to be able to incorporate that into a system of learning, well, people are always going to be denied that truth by deceit and lies. When you look at the type of psychological warfare, spiritual warfare that Aboriginal people are caught in, it's not just in the sense of military when they talk about weapons of mass destruction, but you're right, it's in terms of the media, and the industry of media is a warfare against our people, and so is religion, I believe, in the Western sense. They're all weapons of mass destruction against our people.
We need to keep radical voices on air. Subscribe now.
Go to 3cr.org.au/subscribe or call the station on 9419 8377.
Okay, you're back and you're listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR 855 AM. So we're very happy to be joined today by Isabel. She is a teacher and union member who is based in the inner city region. She has been a teacher for 6 years and is the co-president of her school's sub-branch, and is a member of Fight the Crisis, which is a group of rank-and-file AU Victorian branch members committed to empowering other union members to use their collective power as workers to fight for educational, industrial and social justice. So, yeah, good morning, Isabel.
Good morning, Jacob. Thank you for having me on.
So maybe to kind of start off, Isabel, obviously just a bit of background for our listeners is and we'll go a bit into this later in the next in a later question, but you know, basically one of the big things in the news is that following the kind of really kind of incredible kind of teacher strike that we saw earlier, I think it was in March.
Yeah.
The media has been sort of going on about how there's been a deal kind of reached between the union members and the state government. But of course, we'll unpack why that's not necessarily, that is quite kind of misleading. But maybe to kind of start off, maybe just for a bit of background, can you tell us about the current kind of working conditions and wages for teachers and education support staff and why they are completely inadequate?
Absolutely. I think the first thing is that it is simply not possible at the moment for us to do our work in our paid hours. Teachers are doing roughly 12 hours of unpaid overtime every single week. This came out of a recent Monash University study. And when a large percentage of the workforce are on far less than the median wage, that's pretty intolerable. We're a sector of some of the lowest paid and most undervalued workers, and so we see things like many of our education support staff can't afford to move out of share houses. Most of us can't afford to live in or near the suburbs we're working in, so people are travelling hours to the school that they work in. There are so many examples of excessive workload, but one that I think gives a really clear picture of just how unsustainable the workload is we'll see teachers and ES in schools spending hours and hours collecting evidence and attending meetings to qualify our vulnerable students for disability and inclusion funding. And sometimes you might spend more than 10 hours getting this evidence for one student. But our schools are in such a state of crisis that that money, so you might successfully get, say, $45,000 funding to support a student who needs one-on-one classroom support, so an education support staff member sitting with them in the classroom, and then you successfully get the funding, you do all of that work, and the school will then have to spend it elsewhere because there are deficits in every facet of our education system. And so we are working to the bone and we're not even seeing our students get the supports that they're entitled to. One of the big issues in this agreement was pushing for paid lunch breaks for education support staff. At the moment, we see ES working through their lunch breaks to either complete admin work or to meet student need, and they're not even getting paid for that 30-minute lunch break each day. So, yeah, I mean, education support staff, teachers, they're already burnt out. Lots of us take on a second job because of the way the economy is at the moment. I work as a tutor outside of hours, as do many of my colleagues. So we're just, I think we're dropping like flies. People are quitting their job in the middle of school term. We're seeing pre-service or graduate teachers who are maybe working in education support during their degree having that first-hand experience of conditions and then dropping out of their degree before they graduate because they just see how incredibly unsustainable it is.
Thanks, Isabella, and good morning. This is Mary.
Hi, Mary.
Hi. So, you know, we've heard about this offer. The AU officials have said it's a good offer. Can you say what you think, why maybe it's not such a good offer?
Yeah, sure. So I think the optics of the offer are really good, right? The numbers sound like really big numbers. But we need to remember that in Victoria, we are starting from way behind. We need a roughly 25% pay increase just to make up for the lost wages from our last agreement, which was so inadequate. So we are so far behind other states, and that impact is obviously compounding in lost wages across the years. But the reality is when you break those numbers down, if we look at education support staff who are already some of the lowest paid in our sector, they're only seeing a 21% increase to their base salary spread out across 4 years. That's not going to keep up with inflation. So their real wages at the end of the agreement, they will have less buying power than they do now. And then the rest of that percentage number, they're talking about, you know, 28%, 32%, is made up of allowances or one-off payments, which you can't build upon in the next agreement because they're not in the base salary. So they have to be redefended and renegotiated all over again. And it has real-world impact. If you want to go and apply for a credit card, the bank says we need 3 months of payslips, and those bonuses do not show up on every month of your payslip. So it has real-world impacts on what people are actually able to do with their money. For teachers, some people will have seen politicians out in the media saying, you know, we so support our teachers, they're going to become some of the best paid in the country, and we're often compared to New South Wales. But in this agreement, it's just not true. It will be reasonable and it will be close or similar to New South Wales for those who are at the top of the pay scale and those who are right at the bottom, the graduate teachers. But for everyone in the middle eight or so pay bands, which is the majority of teaching staff, it's not a good deal. If I use myself as an example, I'm going into my seventh year of teaching next year. So in New South Wales, that would put me at the top of the pay scale. It only takes 7 years to reach the top of the pay scale there for a classroom teacher. But for me, I'll be about $15,000 per year behind my New South Wales counterpart. And I'll still be 4 years away from reaching the Victorian top of the pay scale. So
Can I just follow up? So, Isabel, there's a lot of talk about wages, but one of the most important aspects is the working conditions.
Absolutely.
And like previous EBA agreements with the government, there's probably very little, if anything, in there, is there? Can you sort of talk about, because as you said, teachers are dropping like flies or leaving the profession because they can't cope with the working conditions. Is there anything in there that's substantial about working conditions?
Not really, no. The two main workload concerns that we want to see addressed that haven't been at this stage are face-to-face teaching hours and class sizes. So the hours that you are in the classroom with students directly impacts how much unpaid overtime you do, because there is admin work that needs to be done outside of the classroom, whether that's marking, planning lessons, responding to emails, parent phone calls, all that stuff. There's not enough time put aside to do those tasks, and so people end up doing them in unpaid overtime. So we need to see a reduction in that face-to-face teaching to reduce that workload. And the second thing is class sizes. We have huge class sizes at the moment, up to 30 in some classes, and with a much broader range of student need, compounded by budget cuts, delayed funding, where we don't have programs we used to have, like literacy and numeracy support, those students who need that one-to-one support are now just in the mainstream classroom. And so how can a teacher realistically cater to 25-plus kids with highly varied learning needs? So we need those smaller classes in order to reduce that workload burden, and we haven't seen any of that in the in-principle agreement.
Yeah, so that that brings us to the kind of next question. I mean, one of the things as well is I was actually talking to some of my family members about this kind of issue, and you know, actually a lot of them, you know, a lot of them are just judging it based on, you know, what the kind of mainstream sort of media is sort of saying. So basically there is a kind of common perception that this is actually a good offer. So that brings into the kind of next kind of question, which is, what is the position to fight the crisis and other rank and file teachers on the offer? And why are you campaigning for a no vote? Because at the end of the day, this, despite what the mainstream media has sort of implied, and the Labor politicians especially, this is not actually necessarily a done deal. It actually still has to be voted on by the members.
Absolutely. So the deal has only been endorsed by the AEU Branch Council, which is about 150-ish representatives. But the union membership, which is 60,000-plus strong, we have the power to vote this up or down. Our position, which I think is implied in our name, is that we are in crisis and we have to fix it. So parents are seeing the impact of what this is doing in schools. Education workers are seeing it. The profession is so unattractive at the moment that we've got a chronic teacher shortage. So, you know, when I have friends who have rocked up to their local primary school to drop their kids off and been turned away at the gate because there are not enough staff on site to meet duty of care requirements. We're one of the richest countries in the world. I do not understand how we have let it get to this point. So this agreement for us is a bit of a watershed moment. We know the dire state of education, and we know that it can't continue as is. So the teacher paying conditions and the ES paying conditions, they reflect how our successive governments view education work. We've already seen them strip funding. We're now seeing them try to pass this subpar deal. And there seems to be plenty of money that can be found to spend on other things. We spend a lot of money putting youth in prison, yet we don't seem to have that money to spend on educating those same young people. So we are campaigning for a no vote because we know this can't go on. We have to push for change, and we know that teachers and ES are ready to fight. Our union membership has skyrocketed over the last 6 to 12 months. We saw over 35,000 people in the streets a few months ago, as you mentioned. We're angry and we are at a point of desperation. So we have so much left in the tank for this fight, and we know that we need to vote no to ensure that we push to see the improvement to paying conditions that we need. We've got to stop staff leaving the profession, and we've got to entice new people to join.
So did all of Branch Council vote for this, or were there some dissidents, I'll call them? And also, I would have been one of those dissidents. And what would Fight the Crisis see as an adequate offer, and, you know, in terms of addressing these important issues for educators?
Yeah. So in answer to that first question, there absolutely were no voters in the room. I don't have the exact numbers, but it was not a unanimously passed yes vote to endorse the in-principle agreement. In terms of what a adequate deal would look like, we need a significant reduction in face-to-face teaching hours. We need paid lunch breaks for education support staff. The reality is that they are responsible and fulfilling duty of care requirements during lunch, just like teachers are. We need a 35% pay increase for all staff across a 3-year agreement, which will catch us up and then keep us roughly 1% to 2% above inflation. And we need a cap size on classes of 20 students. We can reduce that slowly over the life of the agreement, but we need to know that that is the direction we're going in. These are not extravagant claims. They are necessary repairs to a broken system that has been left to be held up by the hard work of mostly, it's a female-dominated industry, mostly women, education support staff and teachers who are, you know, we care about our students, we care about the experience that they have, but it is not reasonable to continue under the conditions that we have at the moment. It's just not sustainable, and we see that by how many are leaving the profession.
Thanks for that, Isabel. And I guess we're probably reaching to kind of the end of the interview now. Do you have any kind of like final comments you'd kind of like to end on? And also maybe you can also tell us, just in case any kind of rank and file teachers are listening to this program, how can people get involved in supporting the work of Fight the Crisis and actually help campaign for a no vote if they agree with the perspective that you're putting forward?
Absolutely. Thank you. I urge every AEU member listening to really dig into the agreement, think about what we need to change here, and remember that we have nothing to lose by voting no, but so much to gain. There is a myth that a no vote is going to send us back to square one of negotiations, but we can actually look to the recent deal that the nurses did in Victoria, where they voted no in overwhelming majority to their first agreement offer, to the shock of their union leadership. And it resulted in them getting a much better deal only 37 days later. So vote no, convince every member that you speak to do the same. And if you're interested in supporting or following Fight the Crisis, you can find us on Instagram and follow along there. We share lots of resources that you can use within your sub-branches. We have some incredible maths teachers who are breaking down the specifics of the numbers in the deal. And we have lots of branch counsellors who are part of Fight the Crisis who were in the room on the voting day last Friday and can speak to the specifics of how that went down as well.
Yeah, thank you very much, Isabel. I think this is, this has definitely been very informative. And, yeah, all the solidarity to you and your fellow teachers.
Yep. Bye,
thank
Isabel.
Thank you so much. Have a lovely day. Bye.
Yeah, so we're just speaking to Isabel, a rank and file teacher. We're involved in Fight the Crisis. You know, basically giving a bit of an outline on why this, you know, this offer that's being state government offered to the teachers really isn't adequate enough. And probably one thing I would also just like to add on to is, as someone who's sort of been following some of the commentary, I mean, I think it's quite outrageous that all these Labor politicians, state Labor politicians, have basically went on kind of social media and then basically acted like this is a done deal. Like, I just think it's incredibly misleading. And also, it also kind of flies in the face of their professed support for teachers and the profession. The Labor government is essentially trying to kind of take, you know, by the Labor politicians sort of try to go act like this is a done deal. You know, they're trying to position themselves as actually, oh yes, you know, look at how much we support teachers, when it's quite clear when you speaking to Isabel just now that, you know, the state Labor government is actually part of the problem, and it's actually the responsibility, you know, of the Labor government to actually give an adequate offer for teachers.
Well, it's a strategy that they've used in the past when other EBAs have been negotiated. So the message is to send out there to say there's no need to fight anymore. And, you know, a lot of people will also be thinking, well, if our officials are saying this and the government, then I can't see a successful fight being waged by our officials because they're on the same side as the government. So it's a way to try and demoralise people into voting yes.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it doesn't show any kind of respect for the membership process, the democratic process, the fact that actually this deal hasn't actually been voted on by members yet.
Yeah, that's correct.
So I thought we would actually play a song, and this is the one of the songs you put in for our running sheet today. This is School Days by the popular Australian band AC/DC.
Thank you.
So that was School Days by the famous AC/DC. Clearly a high-energy cover of the 1957 Chuck Berry rock and roll classic. And it was recorded by AC/DC in 1975, and it features Bon Scott on vocals, who sadly passed away much too early, and it's most famous for its connection to Angus Young's iconic schoolboy stage uniform that he loved to wear.
All right, so so what we'll do, we'll cover kind of a quick kind of news story, you know, basically dealing with a particular development that's happened in the United States. But essentially, the U.S. Department of Justice has indicted the historic leader of the Cuban Revolution for an event that took place nearly 30 years ago. So essentially, and this is reading from an article on People's Dispatch, but the U.S. Department of Justice filed these formal charges against Raul Castro, and the Department of Justice has accused Raul Castro of conspiracy, murder, and destruction of aircraft for the downing of two aircraft in Cuban airspace in 1996. The indictment filed by prosecutor Todd Black, which must still be approved by a grand jury, seeks a life sentence for one of the top leaders of the Cuban Revolution, which, to be honest, I just find a bit bizarre. Raul Castro is over 94, so yeah. I mean, we're like, there's a certain.
They just want to make sure that they you know, that he won't live past it if they were to get him.
and basically, you know, this accusation is based on an incident in 1996 in which two small planes belonging to the organization Brothers to the Rescue were shot down by the Cuban Revolutionary Armed Forces. According to the United States, Raul Castro, then Minister of the Armed Forces, is responsible for the deaths of the crew members of those planes, who, according to Washington, are merely seeking to assist Cuban migrants attempting to reach the US by sea. Now, I mean, you could possibly speak all day. I mean, I'm not that well informed about this particular incident that happened in 1996, you know, but the main thing that has to be said here is really, what is the political reason why the US is kind of pursuing these charges at this time? At the end of the day, I think this just really just needs to be called what it is. It's a precedent for continued US aggression against Cuba. Cuba's already under a very horrific kind of economic kind of blockade, where, you know, they don't even have access to consistent electricity, etc.
Yeah.
And also, I think that obviously there's a certain hypocrisy. I mean, at the end of the day, at the end of the day, I mean, if let's look at the incident for better or worse, maybe Cuba might have been wrong to take these actions, whatever. But, you know, the problem is Cuba is a sovereign country that, in some right, like any other sovereign country, actually has a right to defend its borders. The US has a right to defend its borders. It can launch attacks.
But its borders are worldwide,
Jay. Exactly. Like, the US can commit all sorts of aggressive acts against all sorts of countries within all the places that has air bases, etc. Cuba doesn't have that right. So I just think,
and it was in Cuban airspace, whereas the US has shot down an Iranian passenger plane. I can't remember the year. I think it was in the 70s. Never apologized for it. And then, of course, you know, all the latest stuff where they're murdering people on fishing boats coming from Venezuela. And that's not in their waters off the US or airspace. The Iranian passenger plane was not in their airspace at all. So yeah, total hypocrisy.
Yeah, it's just I think this just reflects the kind of latest in a campaign of aggression against Cuba. And I think it has to be rejected by all progressive and left wing people.
And why wait 30 years if you considered this was a crime? I suppose the argument is, well, Trump wasn't in power, but previous U.S. administrations clearly didn't view it as a crime. Otherwise, they would have done what Trump is trying to do.
Hmm.
As you said, it's just a political pretext to increase the aggression against Cuba and try and starve them into oblivion. It's just disgusting.
All right. Well, we might play a quick announcement. You're listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR 855 AM, and we'll go on to our second live interview for the program.
The state Labor government has begun works on demolishing Melbourne's 44 public housing towers to be replaced with private housing. Already, hundreds of residents have been displaced, often into unsuitable homes under duress.
The towers on Racecourse Road, Flemington, have become Homes Victoria work sites, while the families still living in the buildings are being treated appallingly.
Join Save Public Housing supporters in solidarity with residents.
Weekdays 7:30 till 9 a.m. as we engage with passing traffic to make some noise and show Jacinta Allen
that the demolition of public housing is unacceptable. Signs and banners provided or bring your own.
There's power in numbers, so see you at 120 Racecourse Road, Flemington, 7:30 till 9 a.m.
Safe Public Housing is a 3CR supporter.
The work cover system is broken. Delays, denials, and profit-driven decisions are hurting real people, physically, mentally, and financially. Add your support to the call for change by the Injured Workers Support Team. Visit the Parliament of Victoria website, find the Legislative Reform for Workers' Compensation System e-petition, and add your name. Stand with the IWST and injured workers. Demand a system that is centred on recovery, dignity, and safety. Sign the petition today. IWST is a 3CR supporter.
Okay, you're listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR, and we are joined today by quite a regular guest for the program, which is Marybeck Councillor Sue Bolton, who is a member of Socialist Alliance and is also going to be running as a candidate for the seat of Broadmeadows for the upcoming state election on November 2026. So I want to kind of... I guess we wanted to have Sue on the program to have a bit of a discussion about... You know, probably one of the concerning elements about Australian politics right now, which is the kind of rise of One Nation. And given that Sue is a Victorian state election candidate, you know, One Nation is obviously going to be playing a big role in this upcoming state election. It is kind of predicted. I mean, I've been hearing kind of reports, you know, from people I know on the left that, you know, One Nation is likely to win a number of seats in the upcoming Victorian state election. And if you look at the kind of the polling results, it's very probable that One Nation will win some seats. It will definitely be winning some seats in the upper house. And of course, one of the contexts for the rise of One Nation, and you can also see this in Angus Taylor's budget reply speech, has been this kind of normalisation of this argument around immigration. And in fact, this normalisation is actually happening. I think I've noticed that you notice that even ABC and SBS is sort of normalising this argument. We're currently in a housing crisis, and the kind of scapegoat for this has been the so-called high rate of immigration. And Sue, I kind of wanted to kind of hear your comments about your comments on the rise of One Nation, but also a counter to this sort of, you know, this racism that is sort of building up against immigration.
Well, I mean, the rise of One Nation is clearly disenchantment with the actual impact of neoliberalism, which we've had neoliberal economic policies, which have had since the 80s, this form of capitalism, which has caused, you know, incredible harm to people. Not that necessarily people at large would necessarily recognise that's the cause of all the pain they're experiencing, but that is where the cause comes from. You know, the privatisation, the cuts to services, etc., and the increasing percentage of the wealth that keeps going to, you know, the top 1% in Australia. So that, and really, if you go, if you look at the chart, up until the 1980s, the wages share of Australia's gross national income kept increasing, and the profit share kept decreasing, and that changed from the 1980s, and actually it changed with Labor government policy of trying to control union, of controlling unions, which they succeeded in doing. So ever since the 1980s, the profit share has kept going up and the wages share has kept going down. So year on year, it's at, you know, record-making levels. And so that's what we've had. And then in a situation, you know, where we have the whole rise of Trump and right-wing politics in the US in particular, because that does have an impact in Australia, people have, I think, even from the first Trump presidency, that sort of gave people who are more right-wing in their outlook, they might not have been part of the far right as such, but, you know, more right-wing in their outlook, the permission to be racist and to be explicit and open and vocalise racism and other prejudice, et cetera. And, you know, that, of course, heightened during COVID. And now, you know, you have seen that the One Nation didn't get that high a vote, really, in the last federal election, and the vote was split between One Nation and other far-right parties. I think now you can see, as the coalition is crumbling and coalition voters and even some MPs and Liberal Party members are defecting to One Nation, I also think a section of the ruling class is thinking, well, we need to jump on board, which is what happened in the United States as well. Jump on board because they want to promote, they want a party that's right-wing that they can promote that's going to be anti-worker and support their profit-making and maintaining capitalism in Australia for them. And so I also think there is a significant amount of ruling class backing for One Nation. Might not be out in the open apart from Gina Rinehart, but, you know, that layer is there, and they're really promoting One Nation and giving resources to One Nation because they want a right-wing party to prop up, even if maybe One Nation might not have been their original preferred option. And then I think, you know, basically politicians, right-wing politicians, have been using migration and trying to, you know, confuse people about what the cause of the housing crisis is. So they're really just using migrants as a scapegoat to let them off the hook. And that's really what you know, One Nation and so forth are doing, and the Liberals, et cetera. They're just letting politicians off the hook because politicians, on one hand, want to see house prices keep increasing. They don't want to see house prices fall, depending on the context in which they're talking. And then the same politician in another time will be crying about how housing is too high for young people to get a chance. But then the next breath, they'll be talking about how they don't want the price of housing to fall. So they're not, you know, they don't care. They just want the market to rip, and they do know that the population, working class, but other parts of the population are divided between those who might own housing and have a mortgage paid off and be doing okay, and those who are struggling with a mortgage or struggling with rent. And so, yeah, there is an element of, you know, some people who are homeowners who might have big mortgages who don't want to see their house prices fall, because if they ever have to sell, they want to be able to cover the mortgage and have some left over. So that's the scenario. But migrants are being blamed for absolutely everything, and yet migration has no impact on housing at all. Like, because we saw during the COVID crisis, migrants are forced out of the country. New migrants weren't allowed to come into the country. International students had to leave Australia. Tourists weren't able to come here. And so if migration was the cause of the housing crisis, we would have had dirt cheap housing in Australia at that time. I mean, house prices did, and rent prices did come down a little bit, but not that much really. And so that's the experiment that shows that migrants are not the cause of the housing crisis. It is the way that a capitalist market works. That's the cause of the housing crisis. And the lack of refusal of government to build public housing and the destruction of public housing.
So, Sue, it's Mary here. Good morning, Sue.
Hi.
So that brings us to the next point, which you've sort of touched on. How can we solve, what are the genuine ways to solve the housing crisis?
Well, I think the most important thing, which was done in Australia after the Second World War, when there were, you know, up until the period where government started to build public housing, there were massive homeless camps in every city around Australia and probably country towns as well. There were massive homeless camps, which is what we're seeing again. And it was really only the intervention of government, especially when soldiers were returning from the war, and also needing workers to live near particular industry, that government started to build a massive amount of public housing. So there were slum clearances in when that public housing was built. So, you know, and I don't know all of the history of the slum clearances. I'm sure some of them are probably fairly brutal, but I don't know that history. But really, the building of public housing would have had a downward pressure on the cost of housing, and I think that is what would happen today if we had a government that was governments that were prepared to build a massive amount of public housing. You'd start to put a lid on house prices. I mean, there are other things that have also had an impact on house prices and so forth as well. The tax issues of negative gearing and capital gains tax and all of that has had an impact on house prices. But the other big thing that's had an impact on house prices is developers and speculators. And once upon a time, the opening up of land for development was done by a public agency, a publicly owned agency. Now it's just private companies. And the private companies deliberately triple out land when they've got land to subdivide and so on and so forth. They trickle it out so that it keeps the price of housing up high, so they keep people desperate for housing. So it's none of the house prices by accident. It's deliberate manipulation of the market. Then you get all of these developers who get permits and councils, and they sit on the land for years, wait for the value to increase, and then sell it off at a killing without building anything. And they sell the land with a permit, which I think should be banned. They should be forced to sell just a vacant lot with no permit being transferred to the new owner. They just deliberately manipulate the market. And Prosper, which is sort of like an economic kind of group, not a prominent one, they've probably got the best data on housing that's left vacant for more than 12 months, both houses and apartments. And I think that, I haven't looked at the figures for a while, but something like over 10% of dwellings are vacant more than 12 months. And they can work that out. Not, it's not like the census. It's they work it out on the basis of, has someone used the utility in that dwelling in the last 12 months? So have you turned on the tap? Have you turned on the electricity? Have you turned on the gas? And that's actually pretty good, in a pretty good assessment of what is a vacant, a genuinely vacant dwelling, which could, you know, they're left vacant for all sorts of reasons, but the biggest reason is probably, apart from maybe, you know, well, I mean, holiday homes would have utilities turned on at least once a year, but, yeah, they're left vacant for, you know, assets to increase in price, which is housing being used as a commodity.
Yeah. So, Sue, well, we're running a bit of our time now, and I guess you are running as a Socialist Alliance sort of candidate for Broadmeadows. Do you want to make some final comments about the upcoming state election campaign that Socialist Alliance will be running and the kind of vision for politics that they're putting in contrast to One Nation and the major parties?
Well, I think Socialist Alliance is running on the theme of fighting for people, not the billionaires. Because I think right at this moment, we need to finger who is the cause of the problems in society. And it is not migrants, it's the billionaires. Migrants are being blamed for everything under the sun at the moment, the housing crisis, but really anything that happens in society is being blamed on migrants at the moment. But it's the billionaires' control of the economy that is causing all of the problems we see in society. So that even if you look at something like the rights of people with disability and the NDIS cuts, you know, they're cutting, the government is proposing to cut really basic things that allow people with disabilities survive and function in society, go to work, be able to get around, and all the rest of it. Meanwhile, the billionaires, all of these big companies in Australia, something like a third, pay $0 in tax. But meanwhile, a lot of those companies would get handouts from the government, or depending on what their source of their profit is, they might get roads and things built for them by the taxpayer, i.e. us. And every single person, everyone pays tax, even homeless people pay tax because we all pay the GST and other taxes and so forth. So everyone pays tax, but the rich people are paying less as a percentage of tax than everybody else. And so that's really got to be our focus, is who is causing the issues. And the other thing that we're seeing is that Australia is putting more and more emphasis on the military spending and so forth. And the Victorian government is part of that. Okay, it's not to the same extent as the federal government, but the Victorian government is investing in weapons companies in Geelong. They're turning the old Ford factory into like a weapons headquarters of Victoria, a weapons manufacturing headquarters of Victoria. And so they're quite happy, the Victorian government and the federal government, to throw millions and millions and millions of dollars the way of the weapons manufacturing and towards the military. And meanwhile, people with disability are having their services cut. And the government is using, you know, I know this is the federal government rather than the state government, but it's the same party, they're using the word fraud to address people with disabilities. And I've been around long enough to see lots of campaigns claiming that people who are receiving Centrelink benefits are fraudulent. Sometimes they focus on single parents, sometimes on people who are unemployed. But frequently when they want to take away your rights, they focus on fraud. And yet all of these services are things that we've paid tax for, so that if you're in the situation where you need those services, whether it be NDIS or other disability services or a job seeker because you've lost your job or single parents payment, you've got that because you paid your taxes for it.
Yep.
Or your family members paid taxes for it.
Thanks, Sue. That we'll have to wind up there because we're running a little bit behind time. Thank you so much for speaking with us this morning.
Thank you.
Good luck with the campaign.
No worries. Bye.
Bye. Bye.
All right. We're just speaking to Sue Bolton, Marybeck councillor and also social science candidate for the seat of Broadmeadows. Hopefully listeners enjoyed that interview. We'll just play a quick announcement and then we'll go through the activist calendar and then we'll go to our final interview for the program.
Workcover system is broken. Delays, denials, and profit-driven decisions are hurting real people, physically, mentally, and financially. Add your support to the call for change by the Injured Workers Support Team. Visit the Parliament of Victoria website, find the Legislative Reform for Workers' Compensation System e-petition, and add your name. Stand with the IWST and injured workers. Demand a system that is centred on recovery, dignity and safety. Sign the petition today. IWST is a 3CR supporter.
Keffiyehs are Palestinian scarves and they're a symbol of support for justice for the Palestinian people. From the traditional black and white keffiyeh to an array of modern designs, explore the range and order online or drop by 3CR during business hours. Wear your support for the rights of Palestinians. Go to keffiyehs.org.au. That's keffiyehs.org.au. A 3CR supporter.
Actually, Saltwood, me and Mary Sott would actually take a bit of a break and actually play a bit of a song for everyone. So we'll get a play Down City Streets by Ruby Hunter. Mary, do you have anything you want to add about this song? Because you picked it.
Okay. So it's the late and great Ruby Hunter. She was 8 years old when she was taken from her Aboriginal family in South Australia. And then she was fostered by a white family. So this is her song about homelessness, which I think fits in perfectly with what Sue Bolton was just talking about and also with our next interviewer.
A song called Down City Streets. I don't have to say any more about it because wherever there's a city, there's street people. Early morn, use newspapers to keep me warm. Then I'd have to score a tree. Come on, help me to see. No,
as it grows. In those days when I was yours, drinking, fighting was no fun. It was daily living for me. I had no choice, it was meant to be. Down to the streets I would roam. I had no bed, I had no home. And there was nothing that I hoped.
Okay, so that was the fabulous Ruby Hunter, Indigenous artist, and I'm sorry, I probably should have given a warning about her before we started, that she has passed away. She often performed with Archie Roach, of course, and that was the song Down City Streets.
Okay, so we are now very happy to be joined today by Kelly Whitworth, who is actually a regular presenter on 3CR for a number of different programs. And we have Kelly on today representing the Homeless Persons Union to have a bit of discussion about and a bit of a report on the kind of attacks on the homeless community that are being carried out by the City of Melbourne Council. Good morning, Kelly.
Good morning, Jacob.
So, Mary, you want to go ask the first question?
Sure. Yeah, good morning, Kelly. It's Mary here. How are you?
I'm well, Mary.
Great. Can you tell us about the attacks on homeless people by the City of Melbourne, please?
Yeah, well, there's a bit of an echo on this line. I don't know if that can be helped, but so we know that the community safety officers, which are now an in-house employed program by the City of Melbourne since October last year. We know anecdotally from the peers that we're speaking to that they're constantly moving people on from sitting and leaning against buildings in the CBD and confiscating their personal possessions. That's the kind of attacks that are happening.
Okay. Can you also tell us more about these so-called safety officers and the move-on laws that you just referred to?
Yeah, so as I just mentioned, they've been employed by the City of Melbourne since October last year. There's 11 of them, and they replaced what council were doing previously for about a year, which were contracting a firm called Crownland Security. And they initially came into a place to accompany local law officers who were going around doing their business of moving people on and taking their belongings. And so we were really fighting hard about those people, and the council then, I think, realised they needed to control the situation a bit more, so they got this in-house team of community safety officers who they reckon they employed to address concerns about safety in the CBD, but no one's really sure what that means and whose safety they're talking about. We haven't seen any data about that. Now we've been fighting really hard since April 11th because a former community safety officer, Joel Owen, got some media attention from The Age and I think Channel 7, claiming that he was fired from his position because he shoved someone in the CBD, but he claims he was only following his orders. That's the training he'd received as a CEO. So that's when we started campaigning really hard about the CSOs, and that's been going since April 11th. And now...
Transfer.
I am, yeah. I think I was just mentioning that the City of Melbourne's now proposing, despite all the scrutiny that's been put on the program and everything that we've revealed, they're seeking to double the number of officers on the ground. So they're proposing to lift officer size from 11 to 22 of these people roaming around the city at a cost of $3.75 million. So they've just released the budget yesterday evening, and that was after a period of about a 3 or 4 week public feedback window. And they've made absolutely no changes to their dreams to expand this program. So we'll be going back to the town hall next Tuesday to the council meeting to watch them usher in this beefed up program.
Hmm. So I just wanted to follow up with a bit of another question, Kelly. I've heard that some of these programs around community safety officers have also been implemented in or have been proposed in other councils. Am I correct in saying these have also been explored in the City of Maribyrnong and also the City of Port Phillip?
Well, I can't speak to any great detail about what's happening with our friends in the City of Maribyrnong, in the Footscray Mall and the City of Port Phillip, but I can speak briefly. I'm not an expert at all, but I know that in the Footscray Mall, the council had employed private security guards as well, and there's a great grassroots community group called Footscray Community Response who have been monitoring that, and they conducted an independent evaluation of that program, which found that the officers were intimidating people. There were some accounts of violence being used, and so the Maribyrnong Council kind of pivoted away from that and said it was going to go down a civic-led response as opposed to the other security guard direction. But now we've learned from our friends at Footscray Community Response that they're just doubling the number of PSOs around the train station. And as recently as yesterday, our friends over there witnessed council workers coming and collecting people's bedding and their personal items from the mall and loading it into utes and things like that. Also in the City of Port Phillip, just a couple of weeks ago, the majority of councillors voted to amend one of their local bylaws, which will actually put into law that officers can remove people's belongings in that municipality as well. So it's really dark days across our inner Melbourne councils at the moment with this criminalisation of homelessness agenda that they're all on, seemingly quite hysterical about public safety, but we're not sure whose safety they're talking about, because certainly the most vulnerable members of the community are not safe from our own councils, and are often not safe from members of the house community who come and attack them. And we know that one fella in St Kilda was recently set on fire.
Oh, my God.
So really tough times, but we're fighting really hard. We're fighting back really hard.
Oh, yeah, I hope so. That just sounds horrific. And, of course, especially homeless women, but not only, would seek to sleep somewhere where they feel safe. So I can imagine that would be in city areas. But I was going to also ask, so is it legal for councils to take people's belongings? And what's the response been from the local community?
Well, it's legal, Mary, in the sense that it's part of the City of Melbourne's homelessness protocol, which they ushered in 2017. And that was at a time, Jacob, you might remember, when there was a mayor called Robert Doyle in the House at the time. And he tried to make it illegal back in 2017 for people to be sleeping in the CBD. And the Homeless Persons Union was around at the time, and we worked with others to fight really hard against that. And we were lucky to prevent that from happening. But the trade-off was that they said, OK, we'll have to restrict what people can carry. So it's become colloquially known as a two bags, one swag policy. And it's just obscene, because in that whole time, like, it's been 9 years since then, and there's been absolutely no moves to provide people with any kind of storage facility, just so people can have some basic decency and not have to lug all their stuff around 24/7. Like, what are they really expecting people to do? Like, homelessness is a fact, and people will have belongings and they need something to sleep on. So it is law, Mary, in the sense it's part of their homelessness protocol. We're just starting to really raise more awareness about that now, and we'll continue fighting really hard on that over the next little while to see some movement there, because that's got to stop.
Yeah, and homelessness, of course, is growing.
That's right.
Mm. So what's the response from the local community?
Do you mean like people that are experiencing homelessness?
Them, but also people that live in the council areas but aren't homeless.
What's their response to the removal of belongings?
To the move on laws as well, and the safety officers, their role and so forth.
Well, do you mean in the City of Melbourne or City of Port Phillip? Because there's quite a difference there.
City of Melbourne, because obviously that's what we've been talking about from the beginning, yeah.
Yeah, well, we haven't had, like, the local residents of the City of Melbourne have not been vocal. We wouldn't really know where they stand. So that's really hard for me to answer that question, I would say, about the local 3,000 residents. I wouldn't know about that. That's not where our supporter base is.
Yeah. I guess probably the question we're probably really asking is, can you tell us a bit about the community campaign that Homeless Persons Union has really been sort of publicising against some of this stuff?
Yeah, well, I just looked up the latest figures, and we're not promoting it anymore, but 938 separate individuals have signed our most recent petition to get rid of the CSO program. That's a hell of a lot of people. Our support is growing and growing on Instagram. I think we've got 500 new people supporting us in the last 4 weeks, which is fabulous. Other people are getting in touch from all different sections of the community wanting to volunteer for the union or support however they can. And we've just recently had a great video series where we've partnered with a number of community legal centres across Melbourne on some great advocacy videos about this issue. They're also really concerned. So the supporter base is growing and growing, and we're really pleased about that. We want to see that grow even more. But really, we want people to get out next Tuesday, Jacob, at like 5:30 p.m. at the Melbourne Town Hall. We want people to be there with us at the council meeting and watch these people speak to their decision to increase this program. There's just no validity for it at all. It's actually causing harm.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, I think we're running out of time now. But Kelly, I think this has been a very good interview and very informative about, because I think, you know, I think it is quite outrageous that, you know, we're in a housing crisis and, you know, homelessness is actually increasing. And of course, what we're actually seeing is we're seeing a punitive kind of response to the issue of homelessness. And of course, we're also, this is a common issue, you know, happening around all around the Western world, especially in the United States, where there has been homeless encampments that have been actually crushed by, you know, state governments and so on. And I think, you know, the fact it is a very common trend that local councils, in the interests of kind of protecting, you know, business interests and, you know, will kind of implement these sort of attacks on the homeless. And so I think, yeah, it's very important we stand in solidarity with people with lived experience of with homelessness and actually oppose these punitive laws that are being implemented.
Yeah, spot on, Jacob. It's not just homelessness, as you say. It's actually the criminalisation of homelessness that we're really concerned about. We really want to turn the tide on this in our city because the streets belong to everybody and everybody's entitled to use public space. So if we don't put a stop to this, things are just going to get worse and we have to think about what kind of city do we want to live in. And we don't want these kind of people roaming around our city, moving the most vulnerable people on from our public spaces. It's just not on.
Mm. And that's a great note to end on, Kelly. And, yes, thank you again for being on our program.
Thanks so much for having me.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, so we're just speaking to Kelly Whitworth from the Homeless Persons Union about these kind of suit of attacks on the homeless and very much, as kind of Kelly said, the criminalisation of homelessness. So we're actually right at the end of the program now. I'd like to thank all our listeners for tuning in this week. I'd like to thank our guests for being on the program. Stay tuned for Left After Breakfast and hopefully you will join us next Friday from 7 a.m.
Yep, thank you. Bye, listeners.
This brings us to the end of the show. You have been listening to Friday Morning Breakfast with Green Left Radio, brought to you by Green Left Weekly Newspaper, which brings an alternative source of information that puts people and planet before profit.
If you like our work, become a supporter from $5 per month at greenleft.org.au/support or free call 1-800-634-206.
Arise, you workers from your slumbers. Arise, you prisoners of want. For reason in revolt now thunders and at last ends the age of Khan. Away with all your superstitions, serve all masses,
arise!
We'll change henceforth the old tradition and spurn the dust to win the prize. That's right, the commies are back, reds underneath your beds and that crap.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.